I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there'll be a unique culinary event called Yin Yang Express. Each of these nights will feature a meal, four courses, and stories and entertainment from the four participants, storytellers, writers, musicians. It'll all be served up Hong Kong style in a pop-up open-air setting. In Hong Kong, these eateries are called Dai Pai Dong. The Friday night will be curated by Rice Paper Magazine, Saturdays by Rain City Chronicles, and Sundays by the writer Kevin Chung. He joins me now to talk about his event, which I've just learned is already sold out, but it sounds fascinating, and if you've got a ticket, you'll find out what Mr. Chung has in store. Or you may want to check out the Friday and Saturday events. You have all manner of creative folk participating, as I said, poets, writers, novelists, comedians. And their stories revolve around the memories and nostalgia of Chinese food, especially the Hong Kong-style cafe kind. The Kevin Chung curated event will feature J.J. Lee, Charlie Demers, Madeline Thien, and Eva Prius. Visit inthehousefestival.com for information and tickets. Kevin Chung is the noted writer of four books, including My Year of the Racehorse and Beauty Plus Pity. His writing has appeared in a number of publications across the country and beyond. He teaches in the creative writing department at UBC and is an editor at joylandmagazine.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is KevinChong1975. He joins me in person today. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Kevin Chong. Mr. Chong, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, even though it's just after 3 in the afternoon when recording this. I can't get away from that after 9 years. I still say good morning
it's
to people.
It's kind of like late night with David Letterman. It's recorded in the day, but it's a late night show,
yeah.
So we'll go with it.
So I understand that this event is sold out. But you're still here to talk about it. So
I'm very excited that it's sold out, but there are three nights to this event, and I think there are about 45 tickets left to sell, and I think they're at about $55 a piece. It doesn't sound very cheap, but when you consider it's a four-course meal with several performers and music, and it's pretty neat, I think it's actually not a bad deal.
Yeah, and I mean, just your lineup alone would sell tickets, I think, even if you didn't have a meal. I understand on Facebook you've posted the menu to the event, is that right?
I just posted it, and I knew a little bit about it before we were doing it, but it was just finalized recently. Hong Kong-style dining has always been interesting to me because it's food I grew up with, and it's also a very sort of strange take on fusion food in some ways. It's food that first came to Hong Kong restaurants in about half a century ago, from what I understand, and it involves sort of Chinese renditions of Western food or non-Chinese food. So you will have like ingredients like Spam or spaghetti or macaroni or pork chops, and they are served in a way that is neither really Chinese nor Western. You'll have macaroni in soup with peas and ham. You'll have Spam with ramen and a fried egg. Or you'll have a pork chop on this orange sauce over spaghetti, you know. Yeah. And what I find appealing about it is the fact that as someone who's Chinese Canadian, as someone whose cultural identity is, bifurcated, it's nice to have this antecedent, something that reminds you that what's Chinese and what's not Chinese isn't sort of black and white, that there are all these sort of gray areas in our lives, and there are these opportunities in which cultures sort of talk to one another.
And I used to grow up, I used to go to Chinatown a lot with my dad, and we would go into places and have sort of Hong Kong-style food. But in recent years, we still have places like that in town, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we were just at Maxine's, or is it Mitzi's? Mitzi's on Hastings and Pender the last week. And then last year I was at Goldstone's. And those are the Chinatown places, but then there are places actually, I think, on Canby, like the Gloucester Cafe, that do versions of that food in a little bit more upscale setting. It's pretty informal too, and there are foods there that aren't necessarily Western either, but are Chinese takes on other cultures. There's
borscht.
borscht. Yeah. Well, if you watch the movie In the Mood for Love, the characters eat steak and borscht, and that's very fancy, and they seem very modern. And, they have curried beef. There's something called Singapore noodles, which you can't get in Singapore.
Yeah, I had a friend who went there, and I asked him about it. He says they don't have that there. Is this food that people have at home?
Oh, yeah. I think that's kind of the joy of it in some ways. Like, I had a lot of memories of my mom making macaroni and soup with peas and ham, or me coming home late at night and my mom making ramen with spam and a fried egg. Yeah. And it's basically like the stuff that's in the back of your cupboard a lot of the time. And it's another thing about this cuisine is the signature drink is yinyang, which is milk, coffee, and tea. And it's
an equal portion.
I'm not sure what the proportions are, but the drink gets its term from these two birds of paradise that are found in Hong Kong that mate for life. And it's that the expression yin yang is also kind of slang for sex. Hmm. So we thought it was a really strong image for this night that tries to combine East and West in a way that's not necessarily contrived, mm-hmm. and that really pays homage to the food that we're looking at.
And so these four that you have in your lineup, and yourself, I'm assuming, will be up there and talking about memories that you have with this sort of food or just Chinese food in general?
I let the speakers really tried to do what they wanted to do. I didn't want to necessarily hem them in by making them talk about Chinese food or talk about anything in particular. I told them that they should speak about food and memory, and I'd rather them have a really good story about eating at McDonald's, mm-hmm. than kind of a dry story about Chinese food. So I think for a lot of people, food really reminds them of childhood, and that's why I know a lot of people who still have these aversions to certain foods because they didn't like them as kids, you know, like we're still stuck to it. And as someone who's Chinese, of Chinese descent, whose Chinese is far from perfect, for a lot of people like me, how we connect to our ancestral culture is through the food, because we can't read Chinese and we don't necessarily identify all the times as Chinese, but the food is what draws us back.
And I've read you in like The Walrus and stuff like that talk about Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this may sound silly, but I mean, if you're at you're eating something, does your mind automatically go to a memory? I mean, is that how you work?
You know, if it's something I haven't eaten in a long time before, sure. And that's definitely the case. But a lot of times it's whether it's good or bad or it's greasy or not, you know, whether you get any pleasure from it. Sometimes you do. Like, sometimes having something just reminds you of all the times you ever had it. I don't know. I think most of the time you're just running and getting to the next place, and you're not really writing a poem about it in your mind.
Yeah, you're just wanting to get the check and leave because someone you know that you don't like just walked in, right? Yeah, something like
all
that.
All the time.
So how did this event come about, and how did they, I guess they asked you to I guess you picked the four people that you want, right?
I picked three of the four, and then like my fourth speaker couldn't make it, and Miriam Steinberg, who runs In the House Festival, had a speaker that she had in mind, Eve. I don't even know her last name, Prius, I think.
Yeah, Prius. I don't know either. I just guessed on the pronunciation.
It sounds like a car.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it came about because I was approached by someone at Rice Paper to do a food event with Ken Sui, who is
the night market guy, right?
The guy who does the driving creative force behind the Richmond Night Market. A really energetic, smart, talented filmmaker and cook. who's done pop-up events in the past. I was the one who suggested trying to do something around this Hong Kong-style cafe food. And basically, Ken did everything else in terms of just the creativity, the updating the dishes, the storytelling component. He was the one who really masterminded everything. And at some point, Rice Paper sort of fell through as one of our co-producers. They're still involved as curators, but we decided to go forward without them. And I was connected to Miriam Steinberg, who has a lot of experience organizing events for the In the House Festival. And she's brought so much of her expertise and her marketing know-how, and she's just great to work with. And I'm just a sort of the third person, fifth business in this story. I try to help where I can. I try to help promote the thing, and I curated one of the nights, which is the only one that's sold out so far, which is really exciting. But I thought of people who would have a lot to say about food, and not necessarily Chinese. I think Charlie Demers is always thoughtful and hilarious. Jia Li wrote a little bit about how his dad ran a Chinese restaurant in a Measure of a Man.
Yeah.
And though that's not, you know, what the book is mainly about, and I thought he would be really interesting too. And I've had him at my class at UBC, and he's an amazing speaker. He's
great, isn't he?
He's just such a dapper man. It's fun to have him around. And I think Eve is going to bring a lot to the event as well. And we have some really interesting music. And I think some of the speakers who are appearing on Friday and Saturday, I don't know all their work, but I think they are a really interesting sort of eclectic cast of folks.
Yeah, I was just looking as you were talking through the list, the Friday and Saturday. I mean, it makes you want to go to all three events because it's just everyone.
Everyone's really good, and the food is really interesting, you know, like...
And if you're a vegetarian...
Yes, there are vegetarian options.
Okay, yeah.
And the Ken and our chef, Tarek Shalouf, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, they have, like, come up with a really sort of inventive way of sort of reimagining these dishes. The yin yang that I talked about earlier is being done as an ice cream. Like, that's kind of interesting, and everything sounds great. You know, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm really excited about the food.
It's a pop-up, so people that are going that have tickets, they probably don't know where it's going to be yet, right?
Yeah, it's got all those eating buzzwords. It's a pop-up restaurant. It's a secret supper.
Yeah.
There's a location that we know that the diners will... be apprised of, I think, in the coming days.
Is the pop-up nature of it because you don't know what the weather will be like?
Well, I don't think it's really that so much as... I think it's part of the excitement, and... I think that's mainly it, you know. Like, and we have these events in sort of non-traditional spaces, and sometimes people aren't... don't want their spaces... advertised on social media widely and have strangers show up on other days.
And you wouldn't want to have gate crashers who haven't paid listening to the lineup that you've put together, right?
Yeah, that would... Well, I think it'd be fun to have gate crashers in some ways, but we don't have enough food for them. That's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned some great places in this city where you can get this sort of food. Do you have a favorite Hong Kong style cafe?
I really like Goldstone's the last time I was there, and Newtown Bakery is a great place.
I haven't
eaten there, and like actually at the diner in a while, and I think that I'm not even sure if it's the same sort of Hong Kong style cafe as so much as dim sum items. But it smelled great last time I was there buying baked goods.
They do have the Hong Kong style. I went there with Gary Lee a couple of times. It's great. I mean, you can get all the pork chop with that. What is that yellow, that orange sauce that they put on top?
I don't know. It's like tomato sauce and cornstarch.
It's sweet and it's also a little sour, right? Yeah.
I don't ask too many questions. and like mainly where I eat it is probably when I'm visiting my parents and there's some leftovers of it, like at the house. And they live in Marpole, and there's a There's a place on, I think, 68th and Granville by their house that has a really, that does that sort of style really
well. Yeah. And it's great. I mean, if you want toast or an egg or something like that, you can get that.
You can get buttered toast with, I don't know, like sugar,
marmalade. Yeah,
sugar on it, or marmalade, or, you know, even pork shavings, dried pork shavings.
Did you teach full-time at UBC?
Nope, I'm teaching just one class this term. I'm teaching three next term. I'm an adjunct right now, and I teach at Kwantlen one class. And then in January, I'm teaching an SFU. So I'm just...
You're all over the city.
Running around, yeah.
Yeah. When you... what is it that you teach, actually? Is it creative writing? Is it fiction?
Or I teach creative writing, and I teach fiction, nonfiction, and I sort of teach some other genres, but in a very sort of superficial way.
Do you find good writing from your students?
Yes. Yeah. Like... depends on the level of the students, because I've taught first-year students, I've taught senior-level students, I've taught grad students, and the first-year students aren't necessarily great so much as promising and enthusiastic. Some of the senior students are really, really good, like the majors, and the graduate students are, many of them are already professional writers, so there's nothing really in so much as discovering great writing as in just acknowledging it.
And I've read that you're a good teacher. I've read that online from reviews and the sort. You've got great people. Like you mentioned JJ bringing him in. I mean, people like that sort of stuff, right?
Well, that's the part of the fun of having a class like that, because I teach at UBC in front of, this term it's going to be 200 plus students.
Really?
And it can be very deadening to be in a big lecture hall and to teach. I'm liking this class so far. I've only taught one class so far, but the room is a lot more intimate, and I don't need to use a microphone, and the class isn't too late in the day, and when it's late in the day, I think students just tend to be groggy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited about this class, and I have one in Surrey, I think, tomorrow.
Mm. Do you find time to write still? I mean, even with the schedule that you have?
I have a lot of trouble writing fiction, because I find myself writing other things just to procrastinate. I think it really terrifies me, and I teach it, so I really have to put my money where my mouth is. Nonfiction isn't a problem generally because you get commissioned to write things, and so once you know that there's a deadline and people want to see it, it's not really an issue. Having it be on spec is, I think, for me, what makes fiction writing very terrifying.
And then you're in the midst of writing a book on Northern Dancer, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
The Horse, which fits in with the last book, I guess. But this is more of a biography, right?
More of a biography, yeah. And I never had in my mind to write two books about racehorses. It just sort of came together about a year and a half ago at a party, a book launch in Toronto. And I talked to an editor about this book, and she never even ended up buying the book, but I had a proposal from it that I eventually sold to another publisher, Penguin. And it shows you the power of just sort of networking and being in one of those publishing centers. And I'm really looking forward to the book coming out. I've written the first draft, and I'm getting edits, I think, sometime soon, and it comes out in April, in time for the Horse's 50th anniversary of his Kentucky Derby win.
That's a horse that E.P. Taylor owned, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very interesting man. You know,
I've got a book on somewhere there.
The Richard Romer biography. Yeah. He invented the two-sided toaster when he was a teenager. He survived a U-boat attack during World War II. And he, in some ways, invented the suburbs in Canada. He helped create Don Mills, Ontario, and the gated communities of the Bahamas. He was a really industrious, energetic man.
Yeah, one of the sisters, I can't remember what the story was. I'll have to look at the Romer book. There were two sisters, and those were the two sisters that apparently Conrad Black had taken their shares
Argus.
Of. Yeah, they're related to Taylor, right?
I don't think they're related. I think they're just part of that sort of consortium that owned
group.
Argus. And then Conrad Black is a very young man, so just sweet-talked them into allowing them to buy their shares. And that's hats off to him. I think at that point, I think Taylor was had divested himself of that company.
Yeah.
He was more interested in breeding horses. I read the Conrad Black biography, the one, I think, by Tom Bauer.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it makes him sound... It's a very interesting approach. And ultimately, Argus was a very diversified company, but Black wanted to be in media. And yeah. So He sold off all the department stores and the tractor company and Massey Ferguson.
Yeah.
And then he bought into all these newspapers, and I think that was, you know, a business model that was sort of at the, you know, the end of its cycle. So
when you look back at someone like Taylor, because that's a figure, I mean, that one has read in well, Romer's book, but then also in like Peter C. Newman's books. Do we have people like that nowadays? I mean, Black would probably be the closest thing, but I mean, Black's sort of not really in business anymore.
Do we have people? You know, it's amazing to see someone who succeeded at so many different fields. Normally, yeah. we have these, when we think of like a mogul, we think of somebody who started a new media company, be it Facebook or Amazon or something internet-based, and they have this, like, you know, nosebleed-inducing net worth because of the valuation of their publicly traded company. And we don't see people who excel at so many different sort of areas and are actually create things. I think that's pretty interesting. And Taylor made his first fortune as a brewer, you really take your hats off to somebody who had that nerve. You know, like I consider myself pretty center of the road politically, but when you see somebody like Taylor, like basically trying to double down on breweries during the Depression, when he had no real family money, it's really you really admire someone who takes those risks. I know I wouldn't be able to take those kind of risks, and so there might be people like that in the world right now, but I don't know them yet.
But it must be fun going back and you know, reading up about all these things and
And
what Rosedale was like in the 50s.
I think that's really interesting. I think what this book does, because there are so many other books about Northern Dancer, is to try to put the horse in historical context.
Yeah.
In terms of what it was like to live in 1964. And I think the other books, which are really well written and really interesting, A Deal with Northern Dancer, don't do that, because they're more concerned about his, you know, breeding career and his racing career. And I think that's important, but I think it's also interesting because I think a lot of people don't know about E.B. Taylor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They may have heard his name very vaguely,
mm-hmm.
and they don't know what it was like to live in 1964. And I was born in 1975, but it's really interesting to read material, be it correspondence or newspaper clippings from that time. Because there's so much of that world that I recognize from my own childhood that's no longer there.
Yeah.
You know, like, because, you know, it doesn't, you know, history, you know, the world doesn't change overnight. You know, I found that really fascinating. I remember researching the Northern Dancer book and seeing an article in the Globe and Mail about the hatless trend, where men were now leaving their houses without hats on their heads, and it was this disturbing trend that had caused a Toronto milliner to shut down.
Yeah.
So
it was like Mad Men then?
In some ways, it was definitely smack dab in that era.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it was Mad Men, but the Canadian version. Yeah. So whatever reputation Canadians have as being sort of dour and starchy and very polite, I think it was doubly so at that time. And it was a time in which Canadians felt like the Americans were going to buy their country. There was so much investment in the country from Americans. You know, at the turn of the 20th century, it was British investment. It was British people helping to build our railroads. And by the mid part of the 20th century, it was the American influence. And now, when we think about how much of a sense of national identity we have, how patriotic we are as Canadians, it's really shocking to see how insecure we were then. I guess we're still insecure to some extent now, but Northern Dancer came at this time where no one felt like a racehorse from Canada would ever do anything or accomplish anything. And he became not only a Kentucky Derby champion, but he became this horse that has passed down his bloodlines to the point where I think 75% of the horses alive today are his descendants. It's quite incredible.
I can't wait to read this book. You said in April, right?
It's out in April, yeah.
Yeah. You said something earlier that, I made note of that I want to ask you about now.
Okay.
The last book was the memoir about you owning a racehorse, and now you've written a biography of Northern Dancer. You said you never had it in your mind to write two books on horses.
Yeah.
I've read that about you in terms of that all of your books don't really... They don't... How to put it? They seem very different from one another.
Yeah.
Was that always your goal, to write books that were dissimilar?
You know, like I think I have a friend who said that in an article. And I always see the through line between all those books, like be it the novels or the book about Neil Young or the book about owning a racehorse, where they all had this sort of very sort of tongue-in-cheek voice of mine.
Yeah.
And they... the novels dealt with loss and families, and the nonfiction books dealt with subcultures, be it online rabid music fans versus racetrackers. You know, like for me, there's always enough. I could always see my preoccupations in those books.
Mm-hmm.
I can see how they're in some ways very outwardly dissimilar, but...
I guess at face value, or from judging the book from its cover, if you will, they seem like they're disparate topics.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe in terms of someone who's marketing books, that I don't write, you know, sports books, like 12 books about sports. I think that's easier to market someone if you're the sports book guy. Maybe I've never wanted them to be marketed it in some ways, or pigeonholed, and that's probably possibly it too. And it's just it's a big world, and there's a lot to see, and there's a lot to know about. And I always try to write about the things that interest me.
Yeah. Have you done much traveling this summer?
Not too much, sadly. You know, because I used to do a lot of travel writing, and I went to Nelson and Cranbrook for a wedding, and went to Denman Island for a writers' festival. I was invited on a junket to South Africa this week, but the Yin Yang Express and classes took precedence.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned Mad Men, and I know you're a fan of Mad Men, as am I. Who's your favorite character on the show?
Oh, let me see. In terms of the storylines, I think everyone likes Roger.
Yeah.
And I really liked Lane. He was such an amazing character, and I was so sad to see him go. Don's... can be sometimes tiring, but he's always like the center and the heart of the story. I guess Peggy's also the heart of the story. There's nobody whose storylines I really dislike. Some of the Betty storylines, I think a lot of people have issues with, and so do I. I think they're really straining to try to give her something, and it always takes you outside of the advertising agency, and I don't think much of the... there's much exciting that happens out of it. You know?
So, see, some people, like, I mean, I happen to agree with you that, I mean, if you took her out of the show, it would be fine.
Yeah.
But I read somewhere, and I can't remember, it's one of those online things that you read the next day, you know, where they reduce the episode to bullet points. I guess they keep her in there because it's the slice of life in terms of, say, the domestic life of the... of the 1960s, or the because of Henry, the political aspects of it.
Well, I would say the same about the kids, be it Bobby Draper or Sally. You know, like you get, I think Bobby had his first storyline this past season, but Sally's storylines have always been very poignant and interesting.
Yeah,
and I think it's been said that Matthew Weiner or Weiner has wanted to explore what it was like to be of his parents' generation. You know? And so you have characters like Glenn, who's actually the producer's head writer's son.
It's Matthew Weiner's son.
Yeah, and he's in some ways this sort of surrogate for his father's point of view. And so I think they bring a lot of perspective into what it's like to be in this time where things have changed really quickly.
The character that I like is Ginsberg.
Oh, he's really interesting. Yeah.
I mean, his whole he claims he was born in a concentration camp. And then the relationship, I guess that's not his father.
Yeah.
I don't know if is he a rabbi? But anyway, that I mean, right when we first met them in the apartment, they were praying in the kitchen. I mean, that was just...
I was really interested to see whatever came of that date that he went on, that blind date.
Yeah, that wasn't that awful?
Jewish woman. and I was really rooting for him.
Yeah.
Him after he admitted that he was a virgin at that scene, yeah.
And he was just rude, and he was, yeah. But it was just hilarious. I mean, it's almost relatable.
But it's really interesting. You have this sort of stereotypical, you know, like we have these sort of neurotic Jewish characters. They're very much part of the mainstream now.
Yeah.
They're not even considered like Jewish characters. But
yeah.
In 1964, this is before Woody Allen. It's right before Portnoy's Complaint. It's not really this very stereotypical sort of paradigm, and you have someone who's trying to, who's emerging in sort of the mainstream, where there isn't a context for him. So Ginsberg's just so strange and out there.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting how they're exploring that.
Yeah, it's been really nice to see you again, and I really appreciate you coming
in
to do this despite the event being sold out.
Well, we still have a couple other nights, and I want people to come to it and have fun. You know, like there's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'm really, really touched because all my friends stepped up and people stepped up and came on a school night. You know,
yeah.
But Friday and Saturday you can go have a nice meal, see some interesting speakers, hear some great music, and then go somewhere else and then sleep in the next day, you know. And
yeah.
Can't do that Sunday.
Yeah, they've got some great speakers on the Friday and the Saturday. Visit inthehousefestival.com for information on them. Kevin Chong joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.